The president nodded and checked her watch. It was approaching 6:30 in the evening in Washington, but 8 o'clock the next morning in Kusong, North Korea, a 13-and-a-half-hour difference. President Harmon had aged since entering the Oval Office following the death of President Billings. When she was tapped for the VP slot, she knew there was the possibility of his taking ill or even dying. He was the oldest president ever elected to office. As president, like her predecessors, she had to make decisions that would have a profound impact on the world. In many ways, the demands and pressures were more than any one human being could carry out, but the Constitution required the post be manned by only one person. The room remained quiet as they studied the grainy images from the satellite. The rocket stood upright, ready for launch. Occasionally, a vehicle would scurry across the open space surrounding the launch pad. To the west of the launch facility was the military base and the small town that serviced the soldiers who occupied the facility. Open fields stretched for nearly a mile to the east, until a mountain range rose out of the valley. North of the missile launch site, the mountains were closer, allowing for a protective ring to be placed around the launch site in the event of a catastrophic test failure. President Harmon let out a long breath and mumbled under her breath to her chief of staff. "This better work, Charles." "It will, Madam President, and the world will be much better for it," he replied. "When you and I first sat down and discussed the issues on our platter, the DPRK problem and Iran were numbers 2 and 3 behind our intent to help those Americans who've been left behind in our own country. In some respects, this could have been considered number 1 on our priority list."
"Because of the nuclear threat?" she asked.
"Absolutely," Acton replied. "Iran wanted them, and so did North Korea. Now they're working together to achieve nuclear parity with the second tier of nations like Pakistan and India." President Harmon looked at her watch again. 5 minutes until launch time.
"I'm also concerned about the advancements they've made in their delivery capabilities. With each test, they prove to the world their ICBMs can reach the U.S. mainland, Europe, or virtually any target they choose."
"Madam President," said Acton reassuringly, "if you pull this off, believe me, the mullahs in Tehran will sit up and take notice. With your diplomatic maneuvering, we may have solved both problems at the same time." The group sat in silence again, staring at the digital clocks tick down to the fateful hour. As the clock struck 8 a.m. in Kusong and the minutes started to tick past the appointed hour, the president grew nervous. She wanted to believe her pressure on the Chinese worked. There was little or no activity at this point. The missile sat alone, pointed upward toward the sky, and the watchful eyes of the U.S. satellite. Today was not the day. Perhaps tomorrow. Chapter 43. November 14th. Mountain above the missile launch site, Kusong, North Korea. Duncan and Park had reached the summit of the mountain ridge overlooking the Kusong military base at 4 o'clock in the morning, allowing them 3 hours of restless sleep. The mountain ridge overlooking the launch test site was rocky. Their trek was made easier by following a mining road that traversed the face, connecting tunnels to a series of abandoned uranium mines. The sound of wolves howling in the distance discouraged the men from taking up residency in the mines for the night. An abandoned shaft made for a perfect den for the wolves. The sun began to rise just after 7 and warmed Duncan's face. He and Park had gathered twigs and crunchy grasses to incorporate into the gillies provided to them. They had settled into a swale of soft dirt in between 2 large boulders that still retained some heat from the prior day's sunshine. By avoiding a soft bed of grass or lichens, they prevented moisture from entering their suits and bodies. Dirt and rocks were the best insulators of heat. Park began to stir, and Duncan reminded him to keep his head down. In the darkness, with only the faint moonlight for them to get their bearings, the men ran the risk of positioning themselves within view of base activity in the valley below them. Duncan had spent many years growing up hiking throughout the desert southwest. He'd taken trips as a teen through Utah, Nevada, and Colorado, where the mountainous terrain was very similar to North Korea's. The climate reminded him somewhat of the Rockies as well. The famous 38th parallel, which formed the border between North and South Korea, split the United States in half, running from the Pacific Northwest through northern Nevada, Utah, and ultimately through West Virginia.
Duncan peered over the rock outcroppings that separated the two boulders. The view below was striking. He took in a panorama of prairie land, complete with tall grasses and the occasional pine tree. It was desolate, except for one thing. An 80-foot-tall intercontinental ballistic missile rose over the next ridge below him, which stood in stark contrast to the peaceful grasslands surrounding it. "Rise and shine, Comrade Park," said Duncan jokingly. "Very funny, cowboy," Park shot back as he made every effort to work out the kinks from sleeping on the uneven ground. He rose to his knees and shook his ghillie suit like a shaggy English sheepdog. Dust flew off and settled around him. Duncan immediately got the visual of Pigpen in the Charlie Brown cartoons. "We did a pretty good job of finding our way in the dark," said Duncan. "The main base is to our right, tucked around the mountain. I can see the tip of the missile from here, but this is still too far away to see the observation area. We're going to have to make our way to the ridge below us." Park moved forward to get a better view. "So weird, right? I mean, what's wrong with this picture?" "The Wasong 18 is wrong in every picture," replied Duncan. "It's their newest technology, a hybrid of their prior successes in the portable Wasong class of ICBMs with the larger nuclear warhead provided by the Taipo Dong. This missile can reach any point in the U.S. or Europe with ease." "I wish we could take it out, too," quipped Park. "It would take a lot of C-4 to topple it, but besides, they'd just build another one. They probably have a couple more in waiting." Park shook his head in disgust. Sadly, they'd rather build missiles than feed their people. Duncan pulled back through the boulders and searched through his rucksack for a protein bar. He didn't want to feel full as they made their way through the rock formations today. "I'm going to trust the bosses on this one. You don't just take out a despot like Kim Jong-un because you don't like him. Clearly the scumbag deserves to die, and I'm going to deliver the bullet. And I just hope they have a plan in place to keep the nukes from flying. Talking a bunch of BS back and forth in the media is one thing. Intentionally instigating a nuclear war would make zero sense." "You're still up for this, aren't you?" asked Park. "Yeah, of course. I'm just saying that I don't want us to be responsible for World War III. Wars have been started on less provocation than this." Park settled in and ate his breakfast MRE, consisting of apple maple oatmeal warmed with a flameless ration heater. The packet contained 1,300 calories, which would provide him energy for the morning. "What's the plan?" asked Park. Duncan took another look over the rock ledge. "It's impossible to see anything from up here. There are no mining roads to assist us this time, so we'll have to find our way down to the next ridge without being seen. As we move closer to the base, we got to move slowly and keep our heads down. I'm sure there are patrols that scan this ridge from time to time. First, we'll establish our hide. Then we'd better think about how we're going to get the heck out of Dodge after the shot." "I have an idea for that as well," said Duncan. "Let's move out." Chapter 44. November 14th. Mountain above missile launch site, Kusong, North Korea. Working their way down the ridge in their ghillie suits was no small feat. Between the suit itself and the added layers of natural foliage, it was like rock climbing while carrying a greenhouse. As they reached the valley below the tallest ridge, the base at Kusong came into full view. It was bustling with activity, no doubt making sure they'd pass inspection if dear leader requested one. "I'm glad they're spending their time and attention on tidying up for tomorrow's big day," said Park as a truck raced across the concrete launch site in the opposite direction of their position. He pulled the spotting scope out of his rucksack and surveyed the grounds surrounding the missile. Other than the buildings on the outer perimeter of the base located to his right, there were no other structures, except for the supposed location of the observation stand, beneath a stand of pine trees below them. Duncan used his binoculars to study the area as well. The launch pad sat in a bowl between two mountain ridges before it opened up into a valley. The dual ridges gave them two possible vantage points. The ridge opposite their current location gave them a couple of advantages. "Park, if we could make our way to the ridge on the other side of the observation stage, I'd have a better shot without the pine trees negatively affecting the trajectory. Plus, there's the added benefit of our escape route." "Okay, let's talk about that first, because I really don't plan on dying in North Korea." Duncan settled in behind a rock and gestured for Park to do the same. He retrieved a map from his pack, along with the GPS device. Duncan laid out his plan. Our extraction point is here at Sin Mi Do, to our southwest. The island is connected by this small land bridge, which allows vehicular traffic in and out to the fishing villages. Our calculations put the distance at 21 miles from our current position, added Park. If we move to the ridge on the other side of the test site, we cut off a mile or so. At a 20-minute pace, that could make all the difference. Launch is scheduled for 8 in the morning. We bug out along the south side of the test site instead of backtracking to our vehicle as planned. Park leaned back and studied the map for a second. You want to abandon the truck? What do you mean about a 20-minute pace? He asked hesitantly. That's the first thing the patrol guards will be checking. Traffic will be snarled as vehicles are inspected. And I really don't think our cover will withstand scrutiny. We're better off walking to Sin Mi Do. 20 miles? With all this gear? Asked Park, with trepidation in his voice. You can handle it. I'm only talking about carrying our weapons, binoculars, and the GPS. I'll carry the rucksack with ammo and the rifle. At a steady pace, we can make it before dark. Duncan, seriously, that's almost like walking a marathon. I walked 8 miles once, 10 years ago. There's got to be a better way. Duncan thought for a moment. The only other option is to identify and prepare our hide, then double back tonight to retrieve the truck. We can bring it to this mining town on the other side of the ridge at Anchong Dong. We'll ditch it and then try to make our way through the roadblocks. Park began to calculate the time associated with retrieving the truck. I don't think that'll work either. We don't have enough time to double back, retrieve the truck, and still have our wits about us to take the shot in the morning. Let's do it your way. But after we get settled in the hide, let's study this map again. Maybe we can come up with another mode of transportation. Saddle up, but keep your head down, said Duncan, as he began to move through the rock formations and descended closer to the valley at the next ridge. The terrain was treacherous and required them to be careful with their footing to avoid a sprained ankle. All of the variables with this mission raced through his head as they worked their way around the launch site. He wondered if there were any circumstance under which he'd call off the mission. This had never been addressed during their brief meeting with Campbell at Misawa. He got the sense a lot was riding on his successful takedown of Kim Jong-un. 2 hours later, the men emerged at the top ridge, facing the far side of Kusong and the launch site. At the lower elevation, the rocket towered into the sky, standing alone, waiting its orders. The view of the observation area was much better from this direction, with one disadvantage. The shot would have to come from behind their target. If Kim Jong-un was surrounded by his entourage of generals and Politburo members, they might effectively shield Dear Leader from Duncan's shot. The other side of the ridge afforded him a direct frontal shot, albeit through a stand of pine trees. The men studied their options and moved to a rock ledge that dropped nearly 100 feet to the side of the ridge below. The more Duncan studied the options, the better he liked the ledge. I don't know, Park. This is pretty dang good right here. It's like a platform, no obstructions. Also, it gives us a clear path out of here down the other side of the ridge. Park nodded. I agree. The report from the Barrett will send them in all directions, chasing their tails. We'll get a decent head start out of the camp before our hide is discovered. Duncan looked around and found an area of soft sand and dirt. Look, we can sleep there tonight. After we take the shot, throw our stuff in the shallow space and dump some rocks on top. In their frenzy, they might just miss it. That'll help. Park pointed over the edge of the rock ledge toward the observation platform. Look, we've got some activity down below. Duncan slipped the ghillie hood over his face and slithered like a snake to the edge. He shook his head to remove a piece of dead grass that had stuck into his ear. He'd taken shots in a ghillie suit before. They were a distraction and required an inordinate amount of concentration. He wondered if the suit was worth the concealment effort in light of the lack of patrols. He morphed into a near motionless shape and studied the activity through his binoculars. I guess our intel was right. They're adding a table and chairs to the platform. They're placing flags behind the table as well as some more chairs. Photographers milling about, checking various angles to take photos. Everything is a photo op for this guy, said Park. Anytime he can show off his military hardware, he appears in his spiffy pinstriped commie suit, black hair slicked back, and a big old grin to match that big old frame of his. Duncan didn't respond to Park's comments, but instead studied the furniture layout. It looks like he'll be walking up a few steps nearest to us. Park, I can't wait until he's seated because the flag might affect the shot. If there's even the slightest breeze, the flag will flutter behind his chair. Do you want to take him out before he gets on the platform? Maybe after he emerges from the car? Asked Park. Either that or after the launch, when he's being congratulated by his buddies. We'll have to make the call as the scene develops. Duncan, this sucks. You've got no margin for error. Do you think you'll be able to take a second shot if necessary? Duncan took a deep breath and looked at the target area again. Doubt it. It's going to have to be one shot, one kill. Chapter 45. November 15th. Mountains above missile launch site. Kusong, North Korea. Duncan had another night of uncomfortable sleep mixed with bouts of restlessness. At times, both men found themselves awake, and they rehashed their plan. Preparation for a shot like this one would usually take weeks at any number of U.S. military installations that matched the terrain. North Korea was an enigma in many ways, which prevented planning. Duncan and Park had to rely upon their experience and common sense to successfully strike their target. Just before sunrise, Duncan's watch vibrated, which brought him out of his semi-slumber. The launch was scheduled for 8 a.m., but they expected Kim to arrive earlier for his usual photo-op session. Both men had their positions ready. Park, as the spotter, positioned himself close enough to Duncan to provide him accurate information without crowding his movement. Neither man expected to take the second shot, but if they did, Duncan would need to insert another .338 round through the bolt action of the Barrett. After filling his rucksack full of sand, Duncan rested the barrel of the rifle on top and sighted in the general area where he expected Kim Jong-un to emerge from his vehicle. The afternoon before, he and Park had determined the optimal position that provided the best line of sight to their target. They had cleared the ground of stones and debris to provide a comfortable place to lay on their bellies as they waited. Once again, the nighttime temperatures had dropped into the upper 30s. As the sun rose, the combination of their faces thawing and anxiety brought beads of sweat to the foreheads of both operatives. The atmospheric conditions couldn't be better. The sky was clear, the air was not particularly damp at this early hour, and there wasn't a trace of wind. It was ideal for a missile launch and a sniper's bullet. The men completed their range card and made the necessary adjustments. Duncan took one final look through his scope at the observation platform, as well as the stairs leading up to it. Duncan checked his watch. 10 minutes till 8. Where are they? He muttered aloud. Park didn't respond, but took the binoculars and began to survey the launch pad area. From the far end, closest to the base, he saw vehicles moving from behind a concrete blast wall similar to those used in airports to protect buildings from jet engine noise. Vehicles approaching. Two military escorts, a black sedan of some kind, another black... Duncan interrupted as he saw the vehicles come within the field of vision of his scope. Mercedes, of course, dear leader rides in style. Duncan's heart began to race as Park announced, "Showtime." The vehicles pulled to a stop, and several armed guards exited to quickly check the perimeter. Their focus was under the platform's decking and behind a thatch roof type of structure near the pine trees on the far side of Duncan's position. Moments later, they waved to their superior, who ordered the doors to be opened for the dignitaries. Several generals in their customary olive-drab uniforms poured out of the vehicles. They scurried about to position themselves near the stairs, most likely according to rank and position. The occupants of the Mercedes remained in the car for nearly a minute, causing Duncan to become concerned. "What's the deal?" he asked aloud. "Hold on," replied Park, who continued to look through the scope. "Of course. They're waiting for the photographer to get into position. Be ready." Duncan exhaled and relaxed his mind and body. Real time stands still for the sniper, but his mind races at lightning speed. Duncan reconfirmed the adjustments he'd made to the rifle he'd never fired. Once the target was identified, Park would call out the final numbers. Park, as instructed by Duncan, began to describe what he saw aloud. Two men emerging from the bends, Nope, nope, not yet. Numbers, muttered Duncan as he focused on the men who'd emerged first. 3 mils, head to crotch, dial 400. Duncan carefully turned the knob on his scope to conform to Park's sighting. Zero wind. Hold 0 mil. Repeat, hold 0 mil. Target emerging. Duncan, they're going to swarm in behind him as he climbs the stairs.
Roger that, Duncan whispered.
The trigger's factory setting on the Barrett AMRAAD was 2.25 pounds. Light, smooth, and crisp, the way Duncan liked it. When he was growing up on the ranch, his dad had taught him to treat his long rifle gently and with respect. His words passed through his mind. Don't jerk the trigger, son. Nice and easy. Duncan focused on his target as he received assistance walking up the stairs, knowing there would only be one opportunity to make the kill shot. Ready, set, squeeze, boom. The recoil hammered the folding stock into his shoulder. The ground vibrated beneath him. The feeling was exhilarating, powerful. The long-range, high-velocity 338 round left a slight vapor trail as it flew through the air, creating a distortion in the atmosphere. The crack of his rifle reverberated throughout the valley and off the walls of the surrounding ridges. Time stood still for Duncan as he awaited Park's report. Part 4. Chapter 46. November 15th. The Situation Room. The White House. Washington, D.C. Once again, almost 24 hours later, the group had gathered in the Situation Room to watch via satellite the scheduled missile launch at the Kusong Launch Facility in North Korea. This time they were joined by Secretary Gregg, whose interest went far beyond the launch. He knew this would be the first and best opportunity for his operatives to end Kim Jong-un's life. This is nerve-wracking, quipped the president, as she settled into her chair and crossed her legs. Once again, she nervously fidgeted with her watch, her pen, or anything else within her grasp. Secretary Gregg watched her for a moment. He held no contempt for her, although he disagreed with many of her policies. In a way, she was the perfect occupant of the Oval Office for him to accomplish his purpose. The deep state that stood behind the secretive work undertaken by Secretary Gregg's assassins would have never tried this bold action if President Billings were still alive. Say what you will about the man's advanced age and gaffe-prone statements, he was dialed into world affairs, especially as it affected the military.
"Did you see those trucks pulling away from the missile?" asked President Harmon.
"Yes, Madam President, it appears they are readying for launch," replied her National Security Advisor. "It appears to be a lot more activity than yesterday, which leads me to believe the launch is imminent." "The incoming weather pattern, as predicted, forced the launch for today," added the CIA director. "In fact, the front has accompanying high winds. If the launch doesn't go as planned, they might need to remove the missile from the launch pad for safety reasons." Secretary Gregg sat in silence toward the rear of the room, periodically scrolling through his messages from the Pentagon. He knew today's launch would happen because the intel received from Kim Jong-un's sister had confirmed it. A slight smile came across his face. A student of military history, his mind wandered to the decisive victory achieved by U.S. naval forces over the Japanese at Guadalcanal on this date in 1942. It was the first major offensive and a decisive victory for Allied forces in the Pacific Theater. Building on their success at Guadalcanal, the Allies continued their campaigns against Japan, which ultimately ended in their surrender. President Roosevelt, when he learned of the success of the combined forces at Guadalcanal, said, "It would seem that the turning point in this war has at last been reached." Secretary Gregg saw today as a pivotal point in world history, one that he was a major part of. Within minutes, Kim Jong-un would likely be dead, and North Korea would be on the path to freedom and an accepted country on the world stage. He envisioned millions of grateful North Koreans streaming into the streets in jubilant celebration as the dynastic, oppressive regime collapsed. "It's almost time," said Acton, as all attention was directed to the screen. No vehicles were moving. There appeared to be some activity near an observation tent at the fringe of the concrete launch pad.
What's happening? Asked the president, as trucks began to streak across the paved roads in the valley without choosing any discernible point of interest. It looks like somebody kicked an ant pile. Have they scrubbed the launch? Asked the president. The director of the CIA walked up to the screen and studied the activity. Something has happened. There's too much activity for the launch to occur now. Let me contact Langley. He pulled out his cell phone and walked to a remote corner of the room and placed a call. The National Security Advisor watched the activity as well, and then turned to Secretary Gregg. Monty, what do you make of this? Gregg leaned back in his chair and tried to look as confused as the others. He held up his cell phone to indicate he'd contact the Pentagon for more information. In this moment, silence was his best ally. Then Acton spoke up with his opinion. Maybe the Chinese backed him down? Who knows what they told Kim Jong-un, but it clearly appears the launch is not going to happen. Madam President, I think you can declare this a success. I don't know, Charles. It does appear that he has changed his mind for some reason, said the President. I want to believe that our diplomatic efforts made the difference. Let's go back to the Oval and contact the Chinese ambassador. Hopefully he can shed some light on what happened. I agree, said Acton, who began to gather up their things from the conference table. The president turned to her three top national defense advisors. Gentlemen, find out what happened, and when you have a consensus, contact Charles and set up a briefing for me. Thank you. Secretary Gregg pushed himself up out of the chair and returned his cell phone to his jacket pocket. He knew it would be some time before confirmation of the kill shot would be received, unless the North Koreans announced it first. Most likely, the new head of the regime, Miss Dear Leader, or Dearest Leader, whatever, would be moving quickly to consolidate power and take control. She'd have quite the battle on her hands with the generals who'd insist on striking back at the assumed perpetrators, most likely the United States. Whether she gained control or not, Secretary Gregg and the rest of the deep state had what they wanted. A war. Chapter 47. November 15th, North Cascades National Park, Washington-Canada border. Ceremoniously standing with one foot within the United States and one foot in Canada, Jungju Lee, a commander in North Korea's Lightning Death Squad, waved 24 of his elite commandos to duck through the crooked fence posts with loose strands of barbed wire running through them. One by one, they ducked under the wire and slapped the concrete monument marking the international border between the two countries. Commander Lee smiled with pride as his special operations forces gained another boost in manpower. Throughout his 9 years working in Canada on a temporary work visa, he'd coordinated the entry of 14,400 commandos within his charge across the porous border between the countries. He laughed with delight as one American administration after another lamented the influx of Hispanics into their country through Mexico, all the while ignoring a much larger border with little or no oversight. All along the northern border, especially from Washington State to Minnesota, vast expanses of prairie grass with no checkpoints or visible signs of security provided illegal aliens access into America with welcome arms. From terrorists posing as Syrian refugees to Commander Lee's highly trained and motivated operatives, Canada had become a gateway, a stopover, into the nation that prided itself in being the most secure on the planet. Repeatedly, for years, he'd proven them wrong. The Canadian government was extremely helpful in issuing student and work visas to Korean nationals, but were horrible at keeping track of their whereabouts. After several months of briefing and training, the commandos were escorted into America at various insertion points in the North Cascades National Park in Washington, where they were handed over to Commander Lee's subordinates. The North Koreans were particularly adept at creating false paperwork for his operatives as they were assimilated into American society. Soon, cities like Los Angeles, New York, Seattle, and Chicago were infiltrated by North Korean commandos as part of their Lightning Death Squads. Kim Jong-un began the relocation program of his best soldiers into the program led by Commander Lee in early 2016. He took advantage of the political divide in America surrounding the relocation of refugees and the open border policies adopted by the Canadians. Kim was never sure how and when these sleeper cells would be activated, but he was a forward thinker when it came to hostilities with the United States. While U.S. administrations came and went, changing policies like the shifting wind, Kim Jong-un focused all of his attention on defeating his nation's archenemy. Over time, his special operations forces had increased to 200,000 soldiers. Coupled with Commander Lee's insertions, another 6,000 had immigrated to the U.S. via phony South Korean passports. Now, 10% of his commandos resided in the U.S., waiting for their moment to shine. A 2020 Pentagon report called the Lightning Death Squads the most highly trained, well-equipped forces in the rapidly ascending North Korean army. They quickly gained a reputation for being lethal when a South Korean patrol boat made the mistake of entering North Korean waters in the Sea of Japan. The commandos responded quickly to the perceived threat, boarded the ship, and executed the South Korean sailors, which almost caused a major international incident. Numerous, mysterious, yet formidable, the death squads were treated as royalty at home. In America, they were sworn to secrecy, except when talking among themselves. They spent their days performing menial tasks, learning English, and studying American military maneuvers. In the last year, they'd begun to test defenses. From time to time, they'd breach perimeter security at U.S. military facilities to gauge the reaction of U.S. forces. They were instructed to take down critical infrastructure, like electricity substations and telecom communications, to determine how utilities reacted. As a small group, by comparison to the population, they'd been trained in insurgency operations. Each was responsible to gather the gear they'd need to conduct this type of terrorist activity, including weapons, explosives, and safe places in which to regroup. They'd even procured chemical weapons, such as anthrax. Commander Lee was a proponent of instilling fear in the enemy with the offensive use of biological weapons. While a biological agent like smallpox or other airborne viruses like pneumonic plague were difficult to control, bacteria like anthrax could be. Anthrax had the added benefit of ease of production. For less than $3,000, the necessary equipment could be purchased on Amazon or at a farm supply store to produce anthrax in a garden shed. Commander Lee was always requesting more operatives as his plans for America grew more ambitious. Pyongyang readily obliged. Soon the border between British Columbia and Washington and the wilderness of the North Cascades National Park became but a speed bump for the influx of North Koreans. This was Commander Lee's ninth day in a row of escorting his commandos to their new home in America. Their handlers eagerly awaited them, and soon they were whisked away into the paths worn between the evergreens, giving little or no regard for the delicate ecosystems the Americans fought amongst each other to protect. He continued to stand defiantly, looking at the open span of forest beyond the border. The dewy mist had fallen on the ferns and lichens, plant species that were protected by the American court systems, ensuring that no border fence or perimeter security would encroach upon the beautiful forest. It was quite beautiful to behold, in more ways than envisioned by those who cherished the forest's biodiversity, a word that didn't translate into Korean because it had no purpose in his homeland. One thing that Commander Lee had learned in 10 years of studying the American culture was that the enemy seemed willing to fight each other with more hate and vigor than they would their real threat from across the Pacific. He imagined the day when his country would use this character flaw against America. Chapter 48. November 15th. Mountain above the missile launch site. Kusong, North Korea. Hit. Headshot. Stand by, said Park. The target collapsed in a heap, generating a smile from both men. For a moment, Duncan watched through his scope as chaos ensued. Orders were shouted, and screams of agony could be heard from a mile away as the target's lifeless body bled out on the platform. Random gunfire in the direction of the ridge across the valley brought Duncan back to the task at hand. Let's blow this joint, said Duncan, as he scooted backward on his belly until he was out of view of the soldiers below, who'd been frantically searching for the source of the gunfire. Time's a-wastin'.
Great shot, cowboy.
Duncan patted his partner on the back. Thanks for the spot. I would have loved to have seen the look on his face before it exploded. It always bothered me to shoot a man from behind. In this case, he wouldn't have extended me the same courtesy. Within minutes, Duncan and Park had changed into their North Korean peasant clothing and buried any trace of their gear. Duncan switched out the barrels of the Barrett MRAN to turn it into a battle rifle and slung it over his shoulder. After one final look around their sniper hide, the two set out in a hurry along the path they had identified the day before. With adrenaline pumping through their veins, the men bolted away from the scene and hopped over rocks like mountain goats fleeing a wildfire. After they reached the top of the ridge, they found the tree-lined cover they planned on using to avoid detection. Time would tell if their advance planning would give them the head start they needed to avoid capture. They fled down the backside of the ridge and in the direction of a nearby mining town. This area was beyond the perimeter fencing of Kusong. Based upon their intel, Kusong was the home to 2,500 soldiers, some of which were supposedly deployed as spy-hunting teams in the surrounding mountains. Thus far, the men had only encountered the patrol sentry on their first night. As they descended the mountain toward the mining town of Anchongdong, Duncan began to notice the activity on the road passing through the valley. "Park, something doesn't feel right," Duncan began as he pulled Park's arm to slow his descent. "This is more than a quick reaction team. This looks like they're preparing for an attack. I've counted 10 troop carriers passing below us, all full of soldiers. How long has it been? 10 minutes?
Duncan checked his watch.
15. They've responded much faster than we anticipated. Either way, the roads are not an option. We're going to have to move southward through the base. If we travel outside the perimeter, we'll meet a lot of resistance because they're more mobile.
Park caught his breath and then weighed their options.
If we follow the top of the ridge around the missile site, we'll have the high ground and be moving in a southerly direction. At some point, we'll have to breach their perimeter patrols, but we can deal with that when the time comes.
Yeah, let's go back to the top and move along using the tree canopy as cover. At least they haven't deployed any choppers yet.
Fine, said Park with a chuckle. You get your marathon hike after all. Keep in mind you may have to carry me across the finish line. This'll teach you to lay off the fast food, my friend.
Whatever, said Park with a shrug, as he passed Duncan and led the way back up the ridge.
Duncan glanced to the mining town one last time and shook his head in disbelief. They were on to us awfully fast. As they reached the top of the ridge, Duncan retook the lead. He was more familiar with traversing uneven terrain than Park was. He'd pick a route that would be easier on his partner, considering his lack of upcountry hiking experience and his physical condition, which was not up to Duncan's. A half hour later, Duncan and Park heard the sounds of helicopters performing a grid search across the area where they'd taken the shot. Gradually, the choppers spread out in all directions, eventually crossing over their heads. While they were able to easily avoid detection, the game of cat and mouse was slowing them down. Duncan was constantly checking his watch and calculating the time to the extraction point. He was beginning to realize their escape was going to require a vehicle at some point, even if it was for a few miles. 30 minutes later, after the helicopters veered off toward the woods where they hid their truck, Duncan and Park reached the flatlands of the valley, which would allow them to pick up their pace considerably. They had only traveled a mile in an hour and a half, and Park was already showing signs of fatigue. Duncan knew the trek through the mountains was the difficult part of their escape physically. It was also the most crucial period to avoid detection. If they weren't discovered in that first hour, then the North Koreans would begin to extend their search and focus on vehicular traffic. Now it was a matter of making better time than the first portion of their escape.
"Let's take a break so you can catch your breath," said Duncan, as he found a lean-to shed with several empty drums in it.
Park immediately leaned against a post and slid down to the ground, where he propped his arms on his knees. The next few miles would determine if Park could make it all the way to the extraction point at Sinmido. Duncan studied the GPS and then pulled out the map. He studied the area for a moment, and then confirmed their coordinates. Satisfied with their route, he repacked his rucksack and offered Park a bottled water. Park readily gulped the water down before standing.
"Thanks. I'm done hiking. Walking I can handle. Just tell me it's a straight, flat shot to the Korea Bay."
"It is," Duncan responded. "We're going to head toward the Taeryong River, where it comes out on the southwestern side of the base. There's a road we can follow that will take us due south. However, somewhere between here and that road will be their perimeter fences, and likely beefed-up patrols. I don't think my voice-throwing trick will work in the daylight. Not to mention the fact these guys will be on high alert for anything out of the ordinary."
Park adjusted his gear and gave a thumbs up to Duncan, who led the way once again. He was walking at a quick pace as the two men talked about the reality of their mission for the first time since leaving their sniper hide. Park began the conversation.
"How long do you think it will take for them to let the world know what happened?"
"That's a good question," replied Duncan. "Everything they do here is carefully orchestrated. Plus, Kim wasn't seen in public all that often. It was kind of like Bin Laden back in the day. They'd release some pictures or video to Al Jazeera for distribution, but you could never tell when or where they were taken. So they might hide it until they get their ducks in a row," added Park.
"Most likely. There are no other sons in the Kim dynasty except whatever little kids that guy had. Remember, he had one of his brothers taken out in Malaysia, and the other spends all of his time out of sight and out of his mind at Clapton concerts in Europe."
They moved swiftly along the pine needle-covered forest floor. The sounds of the helicopters were way off in the distance, and no other vehicles could be heard, as the pine trees blocked sounds from outside the woods.
"Maybe his sister is next in line?" asked Park, before answering his own question.
"Do you think our chap Kensington is playing footsies with Deer Leader's little sis?
Wow, that would be close to the top."
Duncan checked his watch and subconsciously picked up the pace. "We have to make up some time along the way."
He was pretty confident in his source. "I'm surprised her brother would let a Brit anywhere near his sister, much less to be sleeping together, as he implied."
The two continued, and came across a dry creek bed, which enabled them to move quickly toward the river ahead. They pushed through a thick area of underbrush. Duncan could see daylight and what appeared to be an open area. They were almost out of the camp. Just as they were about to exit into the clearing, they immediately dropped to their knees. Duncan and Park had found the river and the road that would take them to the extraction point. They had also found a North Korean patrol of a dozen men searching the banks for the killers of their Deer Leader.
Chapter 49. November 15th. Kusong, North Korea.
"What are they saying?" asked Duncan over his shoulder in a whispered voice.
He carefully walked backwards on his hands and knees to join Park. Their visibility was limited by the thickness of the natural vegetation along the river. The shouting of orders and hurried responses indicated the North Korean soldiers were under pressure to find the shooters.
"Just typical commands," replied Park. "But one officer continues to urge his men upriver. Where's the road from our current position?"
Duncan studied the GPS and then showed it to Park as he replied.
"Two clicks to the south of here along the river."
The voices began to fade, and Duncan crawled to a large pine and stood up behind it. He was only able to make out the helmets of the soldiers, but they were all moving to his right, upstream toward the camp. Duncan waved Park over, who continued to listen. The voices grew fainter.
"Let's go for it," Duncan suggested.
"I'm guessing there were a dozen men in that patrol. Most likely they parked their truck at the road and began searching up the river, probably looking for our footprints on the banks. If we can stay along the edge of the woods, we can make good time to get to the road."
Park was on board.
"Yeah, then we'll jack up their truck. We may not be able to walk our way through their checkpoints, but we can pick up a lot of miles before they notice their truck missing."
"Let's roll," said Duncan without hesitation. The men slowly made their way to the clearing and the river's edge, which was slightly damp, possibly hampering their progress. Choosing the more stable high ground along the bank next to the underbrush, they began running at a steady pace toward the road.
Nearly 2 miles and 15 minutes later, they saw a truck parked in front of a short concrete bridge. It was a standard military troop carrier with a green canvas cover on the back and the red star of North Korea painted on the doors. Park slowed and then abruptly darted into the woods. He motioned for Duncan to join him. "Duncan, they've left a man behind to watch the truck. He may be the driver." Duncan studied the bridge and the area around the truck. "That transport could carry more than the dozen soldiers we saw. They may be searching downriver from the highway. Park, we've got to move quickly."
"All right," said Park.
He pulled his sidearm and affixed the suppressor. He handed Duncan his rucksack and his earmuffs. "Here, trade hats with me. I'm going to wander over there like I'm a lost local."
"But we're still inside their base perimeter fence," cautioned Duncan. "He may not buy it."
"It won't matter," said Park, who was lightning fast when drawing his concealed weapon. "He'll be dead before he has a chance to raise his rifle." Duncan looked back upriver, wondering when the patrol would return.
"Gotta go for it. I've got your six."
Park nodded and slowly made his way toward the riverbank and stopped 30 feet from the truck where the woods ended. He pulled his weapon and stretched the sleeve of his oversized jacket, allowing him to conceal his .45. The soldier was smoking a cigarette as he wandered aimlessly at the truck's tailgate. Park waited until the guard turned to pace in the other direction before he emerged from the woods. He was able to close the gap to 20 feet before the guard noticed his presence and promptly swung his rifle around.
"Nang Minol, Momchuda!"
the guard shouted as Park emerged from the woods. "Stop, peasant." Park didn't respond or hesitate. Appearing to raise both hands in surrender, his right arm emerged from his sleeve and fired a single round into the throat of the guard, knocking him backwards until his body crashed onto the pavement. Duncan burst out of the woods with his weapon drawn to cover Park in the event another soldier emerged from the backside of the vehicle. Park carefully rounded the rear bumper and cleared the bed of the truck, while Duncan checked the cab and the driver's side. Satisfied they were clear, Duncan walked toward the river and looked for any signs of the troops returning. "We're good," Duncan announced as he caught up with Park at the tailgate.
"More than good," said Park with a smile.
"Look what I found."
Park held back the canvas cover to reveal the interior of the troop carrier. 3 long rectangular boxes lay before him, one of which had already been opened by Park.
"RPGs! Sweet!" exclaimed Duncan.
He hoisted himself into the covered truck bed and rummaged through the contents, where he found the coats and caps of the soldiers.
"We can put on these coats and bluff our way through."
"One step ahead of you, Comrade Armstrong," said Park with a laugh. He'd stripped the soldier of his jacket and pants and found them to be a perfect fit. "I pulled his body out of the pool of blood from his throat. Throw me a cap." Duncan tossed him a hat, and Park immediately put it on before standing at attention.
"What say you?"
"You look better than the dead guy," said Duncan.
"Come on, let's toss him in the woods.
We can't do much about the blood."
The men unceremoniously pitched the dead soldier into a thicket of brush and made their way back to the truck. Without hesitating, they fired up the big diesel and lumbered southbound toward the coast. Park turned on the military comms mounted to the dashboard of the truck. The antiquated technology resembled an American-made CB radio from the 70s. As he drove, he scanned through the channels. Duncan checked his watch. It was just past noon. "We're 7 miles from the crossroad where the camp perimeter is located. There will be a manned security gate there. We'll have to make..." Loud static from the radio interrupted Duncan. Men were shouting at one another in a clearly excited tone. Park held up his hand and listened.
"Did they find the dead guy?" asked Duncan.
Park shook his head side to side as he leaned over the steering wheel to concentrate on what was being said. He finally relaxed and leaned back in his seat after turning down the volume.
"Sorry, but I had to concentrate.
Although we share a common language with the North, the dialects are different. The South Koreans have adopted a number of Japanese words and phrases into their language. American words, too. In North Korea, there's a commonly used dialect called Pyongyang. Those guys were worked into a frenzy, making it difficult to follow."
"What could you decipher?"
"I gather they've found our abandoned truck.
They're diverting resources to the west side of the camp.
Good.
Listen up. We're only 2 clicks from one of the base's main entrance points. It will be fortified and heavily manned. Park looked down at the dashboard. We've got a half tank of fuel, more than enough to make it to the extraction point. Duncan continued. We'll still have 12 miles or so to Sin Mi Do. We've got 6 hours to get there. One option is to ditch the truck short of the checkpoint, find our way through the fence, and continue to hoof it as planned. It'll take us 4 hours, getting us to the extraction point at dusk, barring unforeseen problems. Plan B? Asked Park. Try to bluff our way through, but that could be shot down before we arrive if those patrols return to find their truck missing and their comrade dead. Park grimaced. That's a real possibility if they're diverting manpower to the other side of Kusong. They may have called the patrols back already. There's a third option, started Duncan, as a grin came across his face. We've got 3 RPGs and our own firepower. We could blast our way through them and make a run for the coast. At the checkpoint, there are 3 options for them to follow us. We could be in Sin Mi Do in 20 minutes, even in this rust bucket. If they chase us and descend upon the coast, which is a natural course of action, we could get caught before the boat picks us up. Duncan took another look at the GPS when sirens began to wail from all directions. The radio chatter began again. What, Park, what?
They found the dead guy.
We're gonna have company. Chapter 50. November 15th. Kusong, North Korea. Stop the truck, said Duncan, as he started to open the passenger door. He'd rummaged around in the glove box and under the seat. He'd found a rusted flathead screwdriver that suited his purposes. I'm gonna load the RPGs and tear through the canvas so I can stand. We're gonna blast our way through and figure it out on the other side. Park squealed the big tires as he brought the transport to a halt. The forward momentum threw Duncan against the dash and slammed his door wide open. He quickly kicked out his leg to hold it there and jumped out. Duncan ran around the side and climbed into the covered truck bed. Park was slamming his fist on the window, shouting for him to hurry. Duncan found an area in the canvas that had been repaired previously and drove the flathead screwdriver into a patch, easily reopening the hole. With all his muscle, he grabbed the opening with both hands and tore the seam wider until it stretched to the wooden sides of the truck. Within seconds, he'd emerged with the RPG locked and loaded. "Wait here for them to round the bend in the road," he shouted to Park. Duncan familiarized himself with the trigger mechanism. He recognized the model. Several years ago, a freighter was boarded, bound for the Suez Canal. Concealed under bins of iron ore was a cache of 30,000 RPGs destined for Egypt. A UN investigation revealed Egyptian businessmen were using their companies as cover to buy the rocket-propelled grenades for use by the Egyptian military in violation of the UN ban on DPRK weapons exports. Duncan studied the weapon and waited. He could hear the approaching truck rounding the curve. He marked the spot where it would appear. There it was, a vehicle very similar to the troop carrier he occupied. Duncan took aim and fired. The RPG round blasted through the air and hit the truck just above the radiator, tearing through the hood and embedding in the cab before exploding. Debris and body parts from the blast flew hundreds of feet in the air. The resulting explosion of the truck's gas tank also sent a ball of fire skyward, accompanied by black smoke. Duncan pounded the roof of the truck. Go, go, go! Park gave it gas, and the 2.5-ton vehicle lurched forward. The debris covered the road, but Park was able to drive through the grass on the shoulder and avoid large truck parts or bodies on fire. The firing of the RPG had revealed their position, and now it was time to take advantage of their shock and awe approach. Park continued driving, and Duncan leaned around the cab and reached his arm through the window. Hand me the rifle. Park didn't slow down as he passed the Barrett to Duncan. They were now in view of the main checkpoint, which consisted of a center gatehouse flanked by steel gates and concrete barriers that stretched 40 feet on both sides of the entrance. A Humvee-style truck was approaching them. A gunner was scrambling to man a machine gun that was mounted in a turret on the truck's roof.
Duncan never let him get into position. The Barrett, which he'd converted to a battle rifle by exchanging barrels, was now fully automatic and drawing ammo from its magazine. The powerful .338 rounds shattered the windshield of the truck, instantly killing the driver. The vehicle swerved toward the shoulder, causing the gunner to reach for the trigger, but he was only able to shoot wildly into the air. The truck careened down an embankment and flipped onto its roof, crushing the gunner underneath it. "We're gonna blow and go!" shouted Duncan as he prepared another RPG. Bullets started flying at them, pinging off the bumper and skipping along the road beside their tires. Duncan took aim and fired at the guardhouse. It exploded in flames, and the gates creaked as the metal succumbed to the intense heat. Through the carnage, Duncan could see men on fire running in all directions. Some bodies were intact, others were missing parts as they burned to death. He switched to his rifle as Park prepared to burst through the flames and into the intersection. Sporadic fire came at them from Duncan's right. Two soldiers were crouched behind a concrete barrier. Duncan kept their position in his rifle's scope as the truck passed through the obliterated security gate. As soon as the soldiers rose above the concrete barrier, Duncan used two perfectly placed shots to drive .338 rounds into their chests. Park continued southbound, and Duncan took up a prone position at the tailgate to fire upon any vehicles that gave chase. He readied his rifle and waited for several minutes. When it appeared they were clear, he finally exhaled and allowed his tense body to relax. Their escape was far from over, but they'd just accomplished two things. One, they'd escaped from Kusong. Second, they'd just bought themselves hours of valuable time, which provided them more options. He allowed Park to drive another mile or so before he leaned into the window and told him to continue on his course and stop short of the next intersection. Then he heard it. The whump, 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 whump sound was obvious. A North Korean helicopter had been diverted to hunt them down. Duncan had studied the intel on the People's Army Air Force while at Misawa. Kusong was not an airbase for their military. Their closest air combat division was at Kaishan, 40 miles to their east. The base was the primary location for their older MiG-17 fighter jets, but would most likely have Russian-made Mi-24 attack helicopters. Duncan hoped the helicopter hunting them down was a utility chopper along the lines of the Polish Mi-2. While it was likely armed with a 23mm cannon, its maneuverability wasn't in the same class as the Mi-24. Duncan could take it down with their last remaining RPG. However, if the approaching chopper was an Mi-24, he and Park would be burnt toast riding in this truck. He whacked the roof and yelled to Park, "Chopper, we've got to get out now!" Park slammed on the brakes without warning, tossing Duncan around the rear like a rag doll. He regained his footing, grabbed his rifle, and slung it over his shoulder. He unpacked the final RPG and made his way onto the paved road. "I've got our gear!" yelled Park. "Dude, we're so close!" "I know, but if the wrong kind of chopper is tracking us, it'll be bad news, buddy." The men ran for the edge of the woods and waited. Duncan found a fallen tree to hide behind, and he waited for the helicopter, which was most likely following the road. He quickly surveyed the grounds around them. There wasn't enough room for the chopper to land. Not that it mattered, he was soon to learn. Within seconds of the Polish Mi-2 rounding the tree-lined curve, two 57mm cannons released from the chopper's sides. Their escape vehicle exploded, sending a ball of fire into the air and causing a hole to form in the melting asphalt. The pilots of the Mi-2 hovered for a moment to admire their handiwork. A fatal error. Duncan steadied his aim and took advantage of the stationary target. He fired the last RPG. The munition burst from the launcher and maintained a perfectly straight trajectory. Instinctively, the pilot attempted to turn to the right to avoid being hit, providing the RPG the broadside of the proverbial barn as its target. "Bingo!" shouted Duncan, as the Mi-2 burst into flames after a series of detonations of ammunition and fuel cells caused a mushroom cloud of smoke and fire to soar upward. "Yeah!" exclaimed Park as he joined his partner.
They'll know where we are now. We've got a couple of small towns to avoid up ahead, but even walking through the fields, we've only got a few miles until we reach the land bridge to Sinmido.
Piece of cake, right? Asked Duncan with a nervous laugh.
Yeah, sure. Let's go.